Well, welcome to this 2019 January, the 18th, 2019 edition of Ask Your Herb Doctor. As usual, the third Friday of every month is given to the show, which is a one-hour live call-in from 7:30 until the end of the show, 8 o'clock. And this month's topic is going to be just wrapping up the last two discourses from December and November on skin cancer. But to tie in the topic of oncogenes with viruses and epigenetics, with the viricidal activity of selected medicinal plants, there's lots of research. And whilst I know there has to be a little bit of reservation and careful reading around the subject, there's a wealth of new articles being published on PubMed and other quote-unquote scientific peer-reviewed sites, ResearchGate, and quite a few others. I've got lots of 2018 and some even from this month, January 2019, research being done either on new subjects around viricidal components or bringing up old material with a new spin, as we'll see with camphor and some of its immune derivatives. The number here, if you live in the area, or if in fact if you live in Iceland or anywhere else on the planet, is 707-923-3911. We'd love to hear from you from 7:30 until the end of the show. For those people, especially who have experience with Dr. Pete, following his protocols, seeing the benefits. Dr. Pete, again, thank you so much for joining us this month.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who perhaps haven't heard of you and don't know too much about you, I will just give a rundown of your academic and professional background before we get started.
Okay. Graduate study in biology for a PhD, 1968-72, University of Oregon. And since then, following up on some of the ideas that I worked on for my dissertation, aging and cell energy production, basically. And among other things, that includes how hormones and foods promote viral immunity.
Okay, good. I'll just qualify what you briefly touched on there. You're a big advocate of, well, let's call it natural medicine anyway, but a big advocate of food-based help in terms of helping the organism to recover their homeostasis, their balance to fight infection, etc., whether it's producing natural steroids or fighting bacteria and viruses. So you're a big advocate of good food. And essentially in that, I think when I first discovered you, you were the person who pretty much set me straight with fish oils and liquid oils as being being good for you, that actually being very destructive. So you'd spend a lot of time discussing the nutrition aspects of healing, don't you?
And the immune system ideas go way back before I went to graduate school in biology. I had read some of William F. Koch's research, and some of his colleagues found that the treatments he used for curing cancer also worked for curing animal diseases such as mastitis in cows. And he showed that the healthy cow could actually have more bacteria in its udder than the sick cow with mastitis, and that a healthy cow tolerated microorganisms without suffering damage from them. And that was what led me to get interested in the newer research. Jamie Cunliffe in England has what he calls the damage theory of immunity, in which the immune system really is a system for repairing tissue damage. And if microorganisms cause damage, then the immune system, so-called, will clear out the microorganisms that cause the damage. But that's a side effect of repairing the damage. Polly Matzinger, about the same time, came out with the danger hypothesis, and that's very similar, except it isn't really as realistic as Jamie Cunliffe's, because it still leaves it open for seeing the microorganism as intrinsically dangerous, where I think the facts indicate that we can tolerate microorganisms as long as they don't poison us.
Right, or if indeed we're not poisoned by the environment in which we live.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very grand idea, and I think for some people they are successful in putting it into practice. I think, just speaking from personal experience in terms of having been helped by you and guided and put straight about things that I thought were true when I was studying herbal medicine in England back in 1993. It's, like I say, a grand idea to have that common route that the body is intrinsically able to heal itself if you give it the right material. And I don't necessarily mean the drugs, whatever it is that pharmaceutical companies produce to treat, quote-unquote, the illness, but that the body has got a fairly good, it's got an incredibly miraculous way of running, per se, and then it has a pretty good way of dealing with organisms and threats to its own homeostasis, which will hopefully we get into here fairly soon.
When you look at a viral disease epidemic, there are always people who don't succumb to it,
yeah.
And you often find that they have contracted the infection. They have antibodies to it, but it didn't make them at all sick,
yeah.
Or just slightly sick.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to remind myself here, when you started talking about the organism and the cows with the higher loads of bacteria that were actually fairly safe and non-susceptible, that makes me think of the theory of terrain that I read research as I was doing my dissertation on the essential oils of the Labiatae, the mint family, when I was studying my degree in herbal medicine. And there was a couple of French scientists who developed this theory of the terroir, or the terrain of the organism, being exactly what you're saying, the key pivotal moment around which disease will or won't affect the organism, and how the terrain could be subtly changed with essential oils. And I got to learn about the isoprenoids and the terpenes and all of the other volatile smells that we get from the mint family. And I hopefully later on we'll touch on some of those medicinal herbs that have had some fairly recent documentation as being viricidal. And again, I've got to make it plain that people need to do their own research, because when I brought articles to your attention and said, well, hey, how about this? You've said, well, actually, that's not because of this, it's because of this. And I think we'll maybe talk about that a little bit concerning mevalonate and statins and how this whole, it was supposedly a good thing. But let me, can I first start by just clearing up a few questions from the last month about melanoma. We talked about skin cancers, whether it's basal cell or squamous cell or actinic keratoses or whatever they want to classify them at. But apparently the incidence of melanoma has been on the rise exponentially since the 80s.
I think from before that, I've seen that it has increased 500% since about 1940.
Okay, what do you think about that? Do you reasons for that?
I'm pretty sure it's not sun exposure, because it has an inverse relation with altitude.
Okay.
Change that I think is relevant is the polyunsaturated fats in the diet, which have increased just about at the same rate that melanoma has.
Are you thinking this because the polyunsaturates are energy depleting and or producing lipofuscin in the skin, or
Many of those things, the energy goes down and inflammation goes up.
Yeah.
In the veteran study, supposedly to prevent heart disease in the 1960s, they gave corn oil-based diet to one group and regular fats, including margarine and butter and ordinary, moderately, and saturated fat. And the one group that got corn oil in their diet regularly, at the end of 8 years, had three times the mortality from cancer. One of the industry's own studies related to what you see in the animal studies, that, for example, if you look at just linoleic acid, which was the original essential fatty acid, so-called, as the proportion of linoleic acid in the diet goes up, the cancer incidence, mortality goes up right with in proportion to linoleic acid.
Okay, these are just because the pro-inflammatory nature of this in people's diets and in the food chain in general.
And they do interfere with production and use of cholesterol.
Right. Okay, good. I'm glad you mentioned that because we will touch on that again a little bit later. Okay, so I was looking at an article that whose headline was the following, and just wanted you to see if you could comment on this, that the lung cancer incidence decreases with elevation, quote-unquote evidence for oxygen as an inhaled carcinogen. So oxygen at sea level versus altitude, and what you've always mentioned about CO2 being protective, with longevity definitely increasing with elevation.
The insurance companies have known for more than 100 years that cancer mortality in general decreases with altitude, very low in the high-altitude cities. And as the oxygen pressure in the air increases, the carbon dioxide tends to decrease. If they are competitive, the pressure of oxygen displaces the carbon dioxide bound to blood.
So this is at sea level. So people at sea level are much more likely, perhaps statistically, than to get cancer because they don't have the protective effect of CO2 that you'd get at altitude?
It's an anti-inflammatory protective factor.
Okay, good. All right, well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Gowerville, 91.1 FM, from 7:30 till the end of the show. We'd love to take calls related or hopefully not too unrelated to this subject of skin cancer, oncogenes, and then hopefully in a bit here we'll get into some viricidal activity of medicinal plants and ask Dr. Pete his opinion of the structures, because I know he's got a few favorites, especially those things that have dark pigments and or the dark red color, the free radical quenching things like Pau de Arco. But anyway, the number here, if you're in the area, or even if you're not, is 707-923-3911. So I just wanted again to just quickly cover what I found is very disparate information on the one hand. This is all from either looking at PubMed articles or ResearchGate articles. And again, you can definitely offer your impression of those. And I know that you've got a lot of history with bad research being uncovered and you finding information that's completely contrary and or just downright stupid being published. Don't know how it happens, but it happens. It gets into print and people read it, and then you've got to spend the time unlearning a lot of things that you thought were the way you've been told they were. But statins, now I know you're completely against statins, and actually you've got a very different base level at which someone's cholesterol would be termed by you healthy. I know the medical association start looking at interfering with people's cholesterol levels when they get up to 200 or so milligram percent. And you've always said that the elderly, or even people over 50, not that elderly, but people over the age of 50 want a cholesterol level of 200 or 220 to 230. So in terms of what statins do, I saw from their pharmacology that they block mevalonate, or they can interfere with mevalonate, and it's a kind of upstream chemical, and this can cause aneuploidy, and this in its own right is a really quite a serious outcome for using statins. So
if you experimentally starve cells for cholesterol, the same thing that statin does to the person, the cells in vitro are stuck in the tetraploid state. They can't do the reductive separation of chromosomes. And old people's skin is relatively loaded with cells stuck in that state because they're with aging, the cells lose their ability to maintain the production of cholesterol.
Yeah.
And when they get stuck in that condition, then if something forces them to divide, they get the number of chromosomes sort of randomized as they divide, and that can produce cancer cells.
Do you see any protocol, or do you have any kind of answers in terms of rejuvenating skin cholesterol?
Experimentally, and in the cosmetic industry, they're starting to put cholesterol in cosmetics because it, in effect, does rejuvenate the cells. It restores their ability to divide healthfully.
So you can physically, topically apply cholesterol in the form of an ointment or a cream to the skin and expect the skin to take up a reasonable portion of that?
That's what the experiments show, and the cosmetics companies are taking advantage of it.
Interesting. Okay, because that was the whole thing that you'd mentioned about vitamin D production in the elderly. You have to have twice as much or more sunlight exposure to get the same conversion from cholesterol to vitamin D, which is so important for immune health and immune suppression, immune surveillance.
There's half as much cholesterol in the old skin as
half as much. Okay, so that's a potential to look out for then. And I think from an anti-aging perspective, I know the collagen is the issue. Well, is some of the issue in people's skin when they get older, when it starts to look a little unsightly or wrinkly or saggy or whatever, however they'd want to describe it. Do you think there's much that can be done to restore the collagen or the scaffold in which the skin is normally elastic and stretchy?
The cells normally are able to turn it over. Energized cells can eat up the hardened, cross-linked, aged collagen and let the cells produce fresh collagen. And the cholesterol lets the cells divide normally, and so they are more energetic, produce a thicker layer of healthy cells rather than a scaly, hardened layer of aged, flaky cells.
Okay, so there does seem to be, then, from what you're saying, research showing that is beneficial, that if people want to think a little bit of that down, a little bit along those lines down the road, they could probably do something themselves in terms of acquiring cholesterol and again, because it's very fat. Well, it's amphoteric in its moiety, isn't it? There's a hydrophilic head, is it, and a hydrophobic tail. It's one or the other.
The practical way to keep your cholesterol synthesis ability is to avoid polyunsaturated fatty acids because they turn off the synthesis of cholesterol and interfere with its use in the cells.
Yeah. Okay. I know I've had this question put to you before. In terms of raising your cholesterol, you've always advocated orange juice as a good fructose source that would actually increase a person's cholesterol.
Getting the cell energized with sugar and supplementing thyroid if necessary.
Yeah. So if you were able to do this, you're saying you think the cholesterol here itself would be distributed evenly throughout the body and that actually in the skin you would wind up with a higher concentration of cholesterol than before?
Except if your body is already saturated with polyunsaturated fats, they will interfere with it and misdirect, put it into harmful forms. The aging brain has much less, about half as much free cholesterol as the young brain, but it fills up with the ester form combined with polyunsaturated fatty acids.
Okay, so apart, and again, it's just good to refresh me on this subject, but in terms of, you've always said that 4 years is a rough approximation for the turnover of lipids in the cell. So given that you had a completely exclusive diet of saturated fats and you completely excluded polyunsaturates, after 4 years there should be a fairly good turnover within the cells. How is this the same with the brain, for example? If you're talking about the polyunsaturates causing damage in the brain and interfering with energy production and the whole thing for dementia, et cetera, down the road.
Yeah, every night there's a tremendous turnover of the lipids in the brain, but when you're asleep, your blood sugar falls and the free fatty acids tend to be liberated from your fat stores. And so if you have bad fat in your fat tissue during the night, it's going to be in the blood vessels when your brain is remaking itself. So if you can keep your blood sugar up or get your fat so that it's pretty saturated, then your brain every night remakes itself considerably.
Okay. And then, this is again, it's a little off topic, but we've gotten onto the, the topic of cholesterol. What about the, I think you mentioned this chemical to me a month or 2 months ago, hydroxymethylbutyrate as a producer of cholesterol, or a precursor?
It's a precursor that supposedly helps to increase it.
Yeah. I think most people are always thinking about decreasing their cholesterol, but I'm always thinking about increasing it. I know my cholesterol is actually low. I almost have a problem with it. It's probably 135 or 140.
It's very important to get it up.
Yeah,
160.
Yeah.
Bodybuilders are the ones experimenting with this precursor, but I haven't heard much from them about its effectiveness.
Interesting. Well, I'm due to get some basic blood work here done in the next month or two, and I'll see if it actually has increased through using this product, because I know it's varies quite a bit, and I think that may either be a seasonal variation with whatever food groups that we're particularly eating, whether it's fruits and sweet, juicy things during the summertime, or probably gravitating towards less of that and probably having to rely more on things like gelatin and meats and that in the winter times without so much fresh fruit. But anyway, it's coming up for 7:30 here. So if people have any questions, the number is 707-923-3911. Give us 5 minutes or so. I think we have one or two callers kind of waiting. Let's just sit tight here.
Actually, people were concerned about the roads, and I can let you know that the Big Tree is still across the road on the Ave near Weot, but it seems as though the power line is off the road at Elk Creek Road. A caller will call us back and let us know for sure, but still, please drive very carefully. There are traffic hazards everywhere.
Okay, so Dr. P, if I can, if I can get into antivirals, and have you give your perspective, because I know it's very different, and again, it takes a kind of a constant relearning in terms of cementing this, but the viricides per se, whether or not they are the latest and greatest direct acting antivirals or plant-based antivirals that are specific antivirals for things like herpes, or whether they're for cytomegalovirus, or the whole Zika thing that's happened here, or dengue fever. There's lots of fairly current research which has been done on medicinal plants and the components of those, and I'll get into those a bit later and ask you if you know anything about them in terms of the structure, because I think that's the important part. Lots of them seem to be flavonoids and essential oil components, which seem to have quite a high affinity for viricidal activity. But within the actual role of viruses and how they take over the cell to manufacture their own virions and replicate things like hepatitis, they reach huge proportions and burst out of the cell, liberating millions of new viruses. And this whole thing just seems to be so out of this world and sci-fi. Part of our genome is viral, and is part of probably our historical, being in contact with viruses historically, how these things have just become part of our makeup. And I'm not saying it's good. And I don't think you would say that viruses are good either, but in some ways, I think you've said that they are messengers and can be used or can be understood in some beneficial terms. But if you have anything to say on that, then I'll question you about some of the specifics.
a very large part of our genome resembles the retroviruses, but when you wonder how viruses came into being, since they can only exist in the cells of higher animals, they obviously derive in some way from the higher animals' genetic material. And it's only in the last several years that Western biochemists are starting to recognize that there are particles circulating in our blood and lymph system. A Korean 60 years ago claimed that he discovered a third circulatory system other than blood and lymph, which carries particles of genetic material. And about 10 years ago, this was actually documented to not the third circulatory system, but the fact that there are very small particles of nucleic acids circulating in the blood and lymph, carrying genetic information to repair cells or change their functions. The particles are so small that people examining blood under microscopes just considered it to be sort of dust in the background. But with proper magnification, they see that there are these microvesicles, they call, which bud off from the surface of cells, or exosomes, some of them are called. They carry both DNA and RNA and proteins and other parts of cells that act as signals, for example, between a working organ like the lungs and the turnover of cells in the bone marrow that are producing stem cells and immune cells and so on. So all of our organs are communicating with each other through these little particles that are about the size of viruses and that contain genetic information and proteins the way viruses do.
Do you think there's anything, let's say the word useful, about viruses? I mean, I've always imagined viruses just to be the bad guys, and just you don't want to pick up a virus if you can at all avoid it, because there's nothing good about them. And is there anything to be said for viruses? I know most viruses, the smart ones at least, try to keep their host alive, but a lot of viruses, you know, end up with causing morbidity and early death. So
when bacteria are exposed to a dangerous environment, such as antibiotics, they are able, or starvation, they are able to edit, re-engineer their own genes to produce adaptive changes. So it's now recognized that bacteria are capable of non-random, so-called mutations, for defensive adaptive purposes. And when one bacterium achieves the immunity to a certain thing in the environment, they can conveniently pack it up into a little exosome, a plasmid, which they pass on to their neighbors. So it spreads like a viral infection. It's like
I can share the good news.
a self-constructed virus that the bacteria pass on for the defense of the community. And within our body, we're passing these little plasmids or microvesicles to different parts of the body. When we eat another organism, we incorporate some of their DNA into our own cellular DNA. You eat beef and you get some cow DNA incorporated into the cells. You eat carrots and you get some carrot DNA. And in that sense, we're communicating across species all the time, genetically.
Wow.
Kind of equivalent to what the bacteria do defensively. But I imagine that viruses have some of that function, so that if it's in our genes, and if like a bacterium can use its adaptive ability to change its genes or to find this plasma that it has received from a neighbor. I think we have the ability to look into our genetic reservoir, including carrot and cow genes, to see what's useful, and that these things, if they aren't useful, if we're not able to adaptively use them, if our energy is very low, then they can cause trouble. They can interfere with our adaptation. But if our energy is high, I think getting these particles of genetic information can actually increase our repertoire.
Very good. Interesting. Okay, well, I think we have a caller on the line, so let's take this first caller. You're on the air. Where are you from, caller? What's your question?
I'm from New York. Andrew, by the way, great questions tonight. Really excellent job. I want to ask you two questions, but I want to follow up on the cholesterol, because you asked to be in context. The total cholesterol, 225 to 230 for older people. What about, is that the only one that matters? There's triglycerides, there's HDL, and it's very hard to know how to consider those. What are the appropriate ranges, even relative to someone who has a normal cholesterol, let's say, of 225?
Okay. So, Dr. Pete, what would you say about HDL, LDL, triglycerides, in terms of their range? Because I know, actually, let's start off. You actually view, quote me if I'm wrong, but the quote-unquote bad cholesterol is not what you see as a bad cholesterol at all. You see that actually as a building block for manufacturing steroid hormones. Okay, I think our engineer might have hung up.
We just lost Dr. Pete somehow. I'll get him back.
Okay, well, let's just, I guess we can do some music or something until Dr. Pete comes back on. I could just discuss the next subject, but seems a little wry, unless we have him on the line. Well, like I said a little bit earlier on, we'll hopefully get into some of the medicinal plants that have been shown to be viricidal, virostatic, and just briefly talk about some of the compounds that are responsible for those effects. So anyway, I think we have the caller back. We have Dr. Pete back, hopefully. Dr. Pete, you there?
The part of his question I heard was about triglycerides.
Yeah, he said what was the relative proportions of the other components, HDL, LDL, and triglycerides. But I know that you view LDL and HDL differently to the way that they would class them good and bad cholesterol. You don't actually look at them that way. So the question was the relative proportions in terms of what would be healthy or normal, given that you advocate a slightly higher cholesterol than what would typically be seen as a regular normal cholesterol?
When your low-density cholesterol is low, that's what increases the cancer risk or dementia risk, too. But the things that poison your liver or stress you increase the HDL, and it happens that protein that forms the HDL is anti-inflammatory, so it's a defensive reaction to stress. Estrogen and alcohol, for example, will increase the HDL defensively. But the LDL is a protective source of the cholesterol. And if the triglycerides are fairly saturated, they aren't very harmful. They found that heart failure is actually less of a problem if your triglycerides are high, but if the triglycerides are polyunsaturated, that goes with interference with the function of the cholesterol. And free fatty acids are the dangerous form of fats in the blood. They have multiple interference, for example, with oxidative metabolism and the use of sugar. but the triglycerides are pretty innocuous. They're just evidence that you're under stress and not using your sugar properly.
Okay, thank you
for that. My question that I had before Andrew asked that question earlier, that was the follow-on, relates to a 22-year-old. Just to, as an example, he sprains his ankle. Some ligaments are torn, some are stretched. So, let's say one is stretched, one is torn. And he's trying to get back and walking. It's entirely, you know, blown up with swelling and stress, as you know. When that happens, it turns. What are the three or four things that you would do to make sure that it heals properly? Meaning that I think, based on what I've read, is you think that healing is ideal in a baby when there's no scar tissue, but we're told that scar tissue has to form in order for the torn ligament to attach back to the bone and for the stretched ligament to tighten up on its own. You will have to form scar tissue for that to happen. And we're thinking that that might lead to arthritis, et cetera, down the road. So I'm just wondering, right now, to avoid problems with arthritis 20 years from now, what is someone who's, you know, a 22-year-old, what should they be doing now to heal the injury quickly and focus on the long-term low scar tissue outcome?
Things to keep the free fatty acids low so that you use your glucose as efficiently as possible to produce anti-inflammatory things like carbon dioxide. And aspirin and niacinamide, for example, are anti-inflammatory things that reduce the disorganizing kind of scar tissue and promote maximum quality healing with a minimum of excess random collagen deposition.
Gotcha. Okay. And so red light and CO2 would also be useful, but those are more short-term trauma-reducing issues. The actual intake of LOPUFA, aspirin, and niacinamide, you're saying will help reduce the scarring yet facilitate healing properly.
And vitamin D and vitamin K are very important. Getting enough calcium in your diet with vitamin D so that you keep your parathyroid hormone suppressed to keep the tissue energy high, including salt in your diet to keep the aldosterone to a minimum, because aldosterone promotes disorganized collagen healing and fibrosis. So some unexpected things, sodium and calcium in the diet are protective to the healing of connective tissue.
Gotcha. So the last aspect of this, if a doctor tells you, a trained doctor says, gee, the only way it's going to heal is when the scar tissue develops.
Good scar tissue is fine, but the worse your metabolism is, the more disorganized the scar tissue is. So that a keloid, for example, is terrible scar tissue, very disorganized because of polyunsaturated fats in your circulation, disorganizing the healing. A baby in utero with no essential fatty acids in circulation and plenty of carbon dioxide will heal without any disorganized structures.
That's a great answer, and I appreciate that. Can I ask one other question, Andrew?
Very quickly, because we do have a couple of other callers, so let's be quick.
We'll do. So let's say an older person has fungal toe, and they've had it for a really long time. Someone has suggested mixing equal parts of apple cider vinegar and hydrogen peroxide and soaking the toe for 30 minutes each day for about a month. I know you've mentioned sulfur, mm-hmm. but what do you think about this idea? I've tried it, and it does change. It does have a physiological effect, but I'm not sure whether it's a good one or a bad one. So that's
well, how about iodine, Dr. P?
Iodine is a good fungus killer. Vinegar is a pretty fair antagonist to the fungus.
In combination with hydrogen peroxide, because that seems to be a fantastic product.
Both of them individually. I imagine together they work all right, too.
Okay, so that's just another way to do it. So you're okay with that approach?
It sounds very, very safe. You can damage the tissue with too much hydrogen peroxide. Once I spilled some 30% peroxide on my finger, and it turned strangely paper white, and I stuck it in a bottle of ascorbic acid, and in a flash it looked normal.
All right, well, thank you for your call, caller.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you.
We'd like to get these next people able to ask. So, next caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Hi, I'm from Calgary, Alberta, and I had followed your suggestion to take coconut oil, but I find that every single time I try it, I've tried taking it and then removing it from my diet, every time I try to take it, there's wonderful things for me, but it causes me really, really bad digestive distress, and I'm wondering why.
What kind of coconut oil is it?
I did try the the ultra purified or whatever it's called, and then lately I've been taking the scented one. Not scented, but not refined.
I've found that the nice tasting unrefined ones were harder on the intestine, and the ultra refined and even hydrogenated coconut oil I find is easiest on the intestine.
Okay, good. And I mean, did you, just out of curiosity, did you ever find that that happened to you, when you were first starting it, or was it fine?
No, I did find that different brands, if you put it on a hot frying pan and if it smells, then it's more likely to hurt your intestine. It should be odorless when it hits a hot pan.
Okay, good to know. I'll give that a try, and hopefully it works, because honestly, I've had great success with it. Normally without it, I can't go long without eating. I'll get really low blood sugar, but it helps me go so long without eating. It's absolutely incredible. So I'm really thankful for your suggestion, and thank you for having me on the air tonight.
Okay, thanks for your call, caller. Okay, so let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from, and what's your question? Caller, you're on the air.
Caller, that's why we say listen on your phone, not on the radio. 3, 2, 1. Next caller, you are the caller.
Okay, caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question? The other caller should call back, incidentally, if they can use a regular landline. That would be great.
Yeah, I could hear that. I'm on. I'm from Toronto, Canada.
Okay. Wow.
Could you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Go ahead. What's your question?
Okay. What can an individual do who has an opportunity to kind of intercept a psychopath and prevent the damage the psychopath would do to others? I just want to know if Ray Pete has any insight into that kind of psychological condition, because it seems that psychologists say there's nothing that can be done to normalize a psychopath or a cluster B, and I understand it makes up 14% of the population, and
is a psychopath on medication?
Probably. I'm not sure if they are on medication or not, but it might have something to do with bipolar or a separate type of diagnosis.
Well, Dr. P, I'm not too sure there's an answer for it, but if anyone's got one, you have.
Keeping the brain well energized, and that means keeping the blood sugar steady. Sometimes just a very digestible diet can make a person feel so much better that they don't have to exploit and manipulate other people.
And that might have something to do with the sort of narcissistic quality to it, that it might be kind of a sort of a food condition, not wanting to eat or kind of having low-calorie intake. So,
I think the addictive personality that needs alcohol or drugs and such is somewhat in the same boat, needing something that they can't get themselves. They try to control others to make their life better. But if their life suddenly becomes better, by changing their metabolism. I've seen lifetime addicts to alcohol or heroin or cocaine just overnight literally drop their addiction.
Good. Excellent. Okay, well, let's just leave the rest of the show open for people who might want to call in. There's just about 7 minutes left, I think. So the number, if you would like to call, is 707-923-3911. Dr. Ray Peet is joining us, and we'll start to get into some of the topic of viruses and viricides and the kind of latest research that's been done. And we'll probably have to carry this over till next month. So people, if they've listened to this and were expecting to get some more than the last segment of this show on the subject, then next month I think we'll probably carry this over. So Dr. Peet, again, I question you about viruses. I've questioned you many times about things like hepatitis virus, and I know you've mentioned the Zika virus outbreak that I think you would have a very different explanation for, and you've mentioned I think a person's physiology and the terroir of the person being very responsible for actually having an outcome of coming down with it or resisting it. And I think that's quite a fit answer. Let me just hold on a second here because the lights are going crazy in the engineer's room there, so I'm not too sure whether he's lining people up. I think he is. I'd probably just hold that train of thought because we have a caller. So,
okay.
Yeah. Caller, you're on the air. In fact, we have two. So let's take this first caller on the air. And what's your name? Where are you from? What's your question? Sorry.
I'm Robin. Am I on?
Yeah, you're on, Robin. Where are you from?
Okay, great. I'm from West Haven.
From where?
Humboldt County. From in West Haven, Humboldt County.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. What's your question, Robin?
Yeah.
And you should turn your radio down. I think you might have a radio on in the background.
Yeah. Will you turn that radio down?
Good.
One is about gallbladder and healing it.
Okay.
And my gallbladder's not functioning very well.
Okay.
And a friend was talking about doing a fast, a grape fast, which I've been hearing about, like, you know, intense fasting, and that can be really helpful. In fact, my naturopath also recommended it. So I wanted to hear what Dr. P had to say about that.
Well, intense fasting is definitely not to be recommended. So first, I will let Dr. P go for it, but go ahead, Dr. P.
Did you say grape fasting?
Yes.
Yeah, I did.
Years ago, I read a book called The Grape Cure by a South African doctor. I knew people, someone started a little health clinic across the border in Mexico based on the grape diet. So I investigated. That was one of the things that got me interested in the purple pigment in grapes and other fruits as a stimulant to proper oxygen use, combined with sugar and the minerals in grape juice. Grape juice does have great therapeutic effects, or just eating the whole grapes, but either one, it has many therapeutic effects.
So, the caller, Robin, in terms of your gallbladder, do you have things like obstruction, or do you have deficient bile production and fat intolerance, or what's the diagnosis with your gallbladder?
I have fat intolerance. There's nothing showing up on ultrasound.
Right.
But I also have, kind of a whole mix of hypothyroid and some mold sensitivity, and I'm dealing with SIBO right now, and so...
The gallbladder is very sensitive to low thyroid function or high estrogen in relation to progesterone. Progesterone relaxes it. Estrogen tends to cause spasms, the sick reaction to fats is because the thresholds are lowered by the high estrogen to progesterone ratio, and the key to it is almost always low thyroid function. You correct your metabolism by getting your body temperature up to daytime, typically around 98.6 Fahrenheit or 37 degrees centigrade.
I have also definitely seen a good case in point for plant bitters based on things like the Swedish bitters formula, things that will increase your digestive enzymes and your stomach pH and pepsin production and those kind of things, for fat intolerance anyway. Definitely works very well to reduce flatulence and bloating and that kind of thing, which is a kind of derangement of pH. Okay, well, we do have one more caller, so let's get this next caller on the air. And caller, you're on the air. What's your question? Where are you from?
Hi. My question is about, I'm from Eureka. My question is about if Dr. P knows of any medical condition or cause that would lead a person to develop digestive issues where there's like a frequent and loose bowel movements, as well as high blood pressure. Things that just sort of came out of the blue, but about the same time in my life.
Okay, Dr. P, did you get that?
There are lots of things that can be involved, but the stress physiology it is generally involved in both inflammation and a tendency to diarrhea and high blood pressure. And have you had blood tests?
Yes. They've been normal. Everything has looked really good.
What do you think about anti-serotonin?
Low thyroid function with a TSH measurement up to 3 they call normal, but anything above 1 is likely to promote inflammation, including in the intestine. And high serotonin is the main thing that contributes to an overactive bowel, and it's named for its ability to constrict blood vessels and raise blood pressure. And there are drugs that will lower it, such as cyproheptadine, but usually you can change your diet to reduce the inflammatory foods, such as starches or raw or undercooked vegetables that are support bacteria that cause the intestine inflammation.
So less starch and less raw vegetable matter?
Salads and bread and beans and nuts and even potatoes can sometimes feed the bacteria that cause the inflammation and release serotonin.
Okay. All right. So, and you look at that, can you get a measurement on the serotonin that you have in your body? I mean, is a blood test do that? Would blood analysis do that?
It will usually show up as increased reverse T3 and sometimes an actual low T3 count. But the simplest approach to it is to eat a bland fiber. Some people are okay with cooked oat bran as a mush, but some bacteria can feed on that. And cooked mushrooms and cooked bamboo shoots are bland fibers that will often will lower the serotonin and diarrhea effect.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Dr. Pete, thanks so much for your time. I'll give out information about how to find more about you.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, so for people who've listened to the show, every third Friday of the month, we do a one-hour talk show with Dr. Pete as our host. And he can be contacted through the internet. He has a website, which is www.raypeat.com. He's got a lot of well-written articles that are fully referenced and very educational. I will say that they are very scientific, so if you really are a real basic layperson, you might find it a little hard going. But if you have any real interest in science and research and you like to dig deep and find out things, it'd be a very good place to look for the articles that will quote why things he's saying are the way they are. I can also be reached as well Monday through Friday. Either email me or send a voicemail to our 888 number, which is 1-888-WBM-HERB, or my email address is andrew@westernbotanicalmedicine.com. Okay, so until the third Friday of next month, I wish you all good night, and we will carry on. Just for those listening now, I never got into hardly anything to do with viricidal activity of compounds, chemicals, medicinal plants, and how we can, again, through Dr. Pete's wisdom, best arm ourselves with the best possible choice, best possible chance of staying healthy. Okay, so till this same time, third Friday of next month, good night.